The following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Joining us now, Ben Trivett. You can follow him on Twitter, at NotLarrySabato. Ben Trivett, a famous political consultant.
Absolutely.
He cut his teeth in Virginia, and now he's nationally known. He's got a national firm. He won a bunch of races this year in Orange County,
California.
Upsetting the apple cart out there.
California.
And he still follows Virginia, and he is with us now to add a little insight onto what is going on and some financial numbers coming out from those that filed and in the last quarter of 2018, Politico's in Virginia. Ben Trivett, great to have you, Ben.
Hey, John, good morning.
Okay, you're on with Saxman. Let's talk a little football, Ben. Let's start there. You had a good day Saturday. You picked the Rams minus, I think, 7. They covered. Yay. You pick Seattle plus 2.5. You got a miracle there, but look, it goes both ways. Like my father said, did you collect the ticket or tear it up? If you collected it, it's good. But then Sunday, Ben, you went down the tubes. It was pretty sad. It was a sad day for the Ben Trivett gambling enterprise on Sunday. You had the Chargers plus 4.5. The game was over in 5 minutes. Other way. And then you told me New Orleans minus 8 was the best bet of the year, along with Alabama, that they would win that game by 3 or 4 touchdowns, maybe 5, if it's not for a dropped pass by Jeffries, the Eagles win the whole game. So, Ben, 2-2 on the weekend, but you got beat on the VIG, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a rough Sunday. But I like this weekend, I'm going with New Orleans and Kansas City.
Okay, now, very quickly,
like those picks.
You're going with the two home teams. You're going to lay 1.5 against Brady and the Patriots.
Oh, yeah.
And you got a rookie quarterback going against Tom Brady.
Yep.
You think that's wise, Ben? And tell me why.
I think the Chiefs are a complete team. I think Mahomes has been questioned this entire season. He has proven every time that he's up to the task. I don't think that he's even, you know, has rookie quarterback is not even a good descriptor of him anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think that you're looking at a once-in-a-generation type of quarterback here who's going to probably be one of the next Tom Brady's of dominating the NFL for the next 10 to 15 years.
So you like Kansas City minus 1.5.
But it's also at Kansas City, which is a very difficult place to play.
Well, as my father, Sam, who's dead now, who gambled his whole life, he had one football gambling piece of advice for me. He said, never, ever bet against the Chiefs at Arrowhead, ever. And the other piece of advice he had is you're not going to make any money betting against the Packers at Lambeau. That was his two things. Ben, let's get to the other game where New Orleans didn't really look that sharp. You look at L.A., you look at that running game. They're going to go right at them. They got a pretty good defense. They're a 3-point underdog. Why not the Rams in this game?
Well, I'm a big Rams fan, John. I think the Rams have been an incredible team this year. And, you know, I think Sean McVay leaving the Redskins is one of the worst decisions the Redskins have made in recent years. The Saints are a you look at what happened last weekend, and the Saints really played one of their worst games of the year, and still were absolutely dominant in the second half. I just think the Saints defense is so underrated. They're so much better than anyone gives them credit for. And the Saints' offense is always good. They're playing in New Orleans, in the Dome. I like the Saints. I think it's going to be a great game, but I think the Saints will cover those points.
Okay, Ben Trivett's two picks this week he likes.
Like it.
Kansas City minus 1.5 at home at Arrowhead. It's going to be frigid there. And he also likes the Saints minus 3 in the Dome at home. I'm going with the Patriots. Somebody's going to have to beat him. I'm going to take the 1.5. But I kind of agree with you, Ben. I mean, they're at home. It's three. I don't really like the game because I think the Rams are a good team, and they are going to run the football, and they are going to control the clock. But you really can't see them going into New Orleans and pulling that upset. Far as New England's concerned, I'm going to bet them until somebody beats them. I mean, that game on Saturday, Belichick had such a great game plan. He ran right at them. It's just tough betting against New England, Brady, Belichick, with rookie quarterback. So I'm going to go with the Pats. So we'll see how that turns out. Ben, I got to get to politics. The financials came out. Headlines, what are they?
Well, you know, the challenges we're seeing to both incumbent leaders, or I should say, you know, Dick Sassoloff being still the incumbent leader and David Toscano having just left as the Democratic leader. The headline is both of them seem to be widely funded by one individual, which is Sonia Smith from Charlottesville. Now, I don't know all of the issues that Mrs. Smith has, but she funded $100,000 into Sally Hudson's campaign. Hudson has really impressed people so far. She's come out early on, gotten some real momentum going. She raised about $133,000 in December to her primary challenge to Toscano, with Ms. Smith, you know, representing $100,000 of that. And I don't want to make it seem as if, you know, there's no other support behind these candidacies. I mean, Sally had one of the most impressive lists of people contributing $100 or less. I think it was over 250 people, and had a great kickoff. But what you're seeing is there is real money flowing into these challenger races in the primaries. And what Ms. Smith is doing is really equalizing the playing field for both of these challengers and letting them quickly catch up to the cash on hand that Toscano and Sassoloff have. And I think that where those primaries stand are very different places right now. I think that the Toscano primary looks like it's going to be very competitive. I think that there are a lot of different issues that are breaking there that suggest that, you know, the 57th district this year could very well turn him out of office in June. I haven't seen that same momentum captured by Yasmin against Dick Sassoloff. And I would point out, John, you know, you look at the reports, and one of the things that you can see on it is, you know, just the campaign's level of organization. Do they have to file amended reports with major errors? I mean, everyone sometimes has to amend their reports with some minor things, but were there big things that went wrong in the reports that they have to fix? And, you know, Yasmin still hasn't gotten her correct report up. She put in a thing that had all sorts of wrong information in it, was missing all sorts of activity that people had seen her have. Her first report claimed she hadn't made a single expense yet, even though she has a grip card and a website and has had staff. And so, you know, that type of those types of mistakes and just tell you a lack of organization in the campaign, which I think has been reflected in the other things I've seen, which is why at this point, you know, I'm calling Sassoloff a very heavy favorite in his primary challenge, while I think the Charlottesville challenge very well may be a toss-up.
I think Sassoloff is way ahead. I think he's going to win that race. And look, I'm not really that familiar with the Charlottesville, Virginia challenge to Toscano. I thought it was odd that you would go from minority leader to a backbencher in the House. Like, why would you even do that? Normally, if you retire or don't want that leadership position, you would just get out. So I found that whole thing odd to me, you know, coupled with the fact that, you know, you would agree with me, I'm sure, the Democrats probably have a better than 50-50 chance of taking the gavel going into 2019 election. He could have been speaker. So you give it up, and then you're still there. Now you're a backbencher. I really never got that, and I think he's vulnerable, Toscano is. Sassoloff, on the other hand, I think is going to get well over 60% and win easy. You know, he's out there banging on doors. He's working hard. He's never neglected his constituents. Sassoloff is going to be the nominee.
Well, who is this Sonia Smith that's given the challengers $150,000 in these two races?
Yeah, but Ben, who is it?
I don't know much.
She gave $100,000 to
a supporter of Tom Perriello's, but I don't know much about her, what issues are most important to her.
I mean, she gave $100,000 to Toscano's
right.
opponent, and then $50,000 to Sassoloff's opponent, which is the bulk of their
right.
their contributions.
Well, she's super liberal, obviously, and probably a perennial supporter in Charlottesville, as Ben mentioned. Ben, let's get to Kirk Cox trying to keep the House for the Republicans. He raised about $2.5 million for his caucus. Not a bad haul, being that he represents what I call the Richmond coin toss Republicans. Now, how does he go forward here? How does my contention is the state Senate in Virginia is almost a lost cause. The only hope they have of holding on to it is if Ramadan runs and Trump supporters like me hold their nose and go with the guy because he's the only hope for them to win the Dick Black Senate seat. And there's like five big ifs there. You know, if we go for him, if he runs, if he raises money, if we hold our nose, if he wins the primary. Other than that, that seat's gone and the Dems win. That leaves the House, right? My contention is Kirk Cox goes and it's the end of the Republican Party in Virginia as we know it forever, because Cox is the only person, as long as he's the speaker and has that level of authority, that can raise money. He goes, it's over. They can't raise any money. Eileen Fillercorn becomes a speaker, and the Republican Party basically dissolves, as far as I'm concerned, in Virginia. All it is now is a postal permit anyway. There's going to be a challenge to Jack Wilson. He's dead man walking. The whole thing is a disaster. What happens to the Republicans now in Virginia?
Well, first of all, I think the Republicans had a very good finance report in both the Senate and the House this cycle. When you look at the Democrats in the Senate, and short of Dick Sasslaw and a couple of other people that barely cracked even $100,000, which I think was Adam Eben and Scott Servo this period, there was very little activity on the Democratic side versus the Republican side. I want to say 9 of the top 10 fundraisers were Republicans. And so the Republicans are certainly building up a pot of money that they're going to need to compete. The governor obviously always has a good pot of money to put behind his candidates. And so from what I can tell, the Republicans are going to be money competitive this year in the Senate and the House. They're not going to be overrun by just what the governor does. And so, you know, that's a big accomplishment for them. Usually the governor is able to vastly outspend people. And the Republicans are raising money at a clip that suggests to me that they may not be vastly outspent this year.
Okay.
In terms of the Senate, you know, I wouldn't say that the outcome is determined. I mean, you look at the Richmond seat of Glenn Sturdivant, which is one of the two that everyone thinks, you know, has to flip. The three Democratic candidates really struggled raising money this period. Glenn raised a lot of money. Obviously, his colleagues raised a lot of money. That's going to go towards him. I would not count him as a dead man walking yet. And when you see that weak showing, and part of this, you know, I would pin on actually the new congresswoman in the 7th District, Abigail Spanberger, who went in out of loyalty to Eileen Bedell and endorsed her early on. Eileen has had a very weak showing so far, and Spanberger's endorsement has deterred other people from getting in the race. So Spanberger's really messed up that race in Richmond because the Democrats are struggling to get a stronger candidate to run because of her endorsement, yet her candidate's not doing much. That's really a bad situation there. And if the Republicans are able to hang on to that seat because of the errors the Dems are making, really the Senate will probably come down to the Dick Black seat in Loudoun County.
Right.
And while I would say today the Democrats are favored to pick that up,
right.
I would not in any circumstances ever want to ride an entire election cycle on the basis of one seat, because things can happen.
Right. But that's kind of where we are. I agree with your analysis, Ben, spot on 100%. We don't always agree, but we do today. I think you're absolutely right. Glenn Sturdivant is proving to be a much tougher candidate on the Republican side than the Democrats ever dreamed he would be. And he's a very, very good campaigner. He's going to continue to raise money after this General Assembly ends. And I think he's going to be right now a little bit tougher to beat than they thought he was at the beginning. He's also a very good candidate. He doesn't make a mistake, hard worker. He's going to be tough to beat. And they also thought they could beat Siobhan Dunavant. Not going to happen. She is going to get reelected. I get her as a heavy favorite. Good luck beating her. And I believe if she wins reelection, She's going to challenge Abigail Spanberger in 2020 for the 7th District seat. But then you get to Dick Black's district. I think that's what, District 19. And, I mean, you look at the candidates there. You got, you know, the young fella, some young fella who's a supervisor in Loudoun County or something. I mean, he's not going to win. He can't raise any money. And you look at some of the other candidates, some of the right-wingers there, forget that. They're not going to win in this climate, the Tea Partiers. So you got one guy, and that's Ramadan, and his David Ramadan, former House of Delegates member. And his problem is the Trump base despises the guy because he is the number one never-Trumper Republican in Virginia, second only to who? Ken Cuccinelli, perhaps. So everybody on the Trump side hates the guy.
Well, you also have Ron Meyer up there.
Ron Meyer doesn't have a shot. He's 30 years old.
He's on the county board of supervisors. He runs a local race. He could localize that election very quickly. I'm not saying he's going to be more competitive than Ramadan, but I'm saying you're not mentioning him as being a competitive.
He's not. If he gets the nomination, he's 30 years old. He has no ability to raise that kind of money. He's never run this kind of a campaign. He loses. I don't care who the Democratic candidate is. He's not strong enough. I mean, it's like a pipe dream. So you got one guy, Ramadan, and he's got to get through the Trump battle, and I'm not sure that he can do that. Ben, what do you think?
I actually agree with Chris Saxman. Ramadan is a great candidate for the Republicans, but so is Ron Meyer. You know, and I think that both of them will be credible Republican candidates in that district.
I don't see how Ron Meyer could put a campaign together and win a district. You guys got to remember, this is going to determine the outcome of power in the Senate. So whoever the Democratic candidate is, they're going to get so much outside money. They're going to get millions and millions of dollars in a district attending blue, running against a one-term supervisor from a corner of Loudoun County who's 30 years old. That's never held a job outside of politics. I just don't see how you win that kind of a race. Ramadan? Look, guy was a House of Delegates member, won a swing district several times, his proven ability to raise money, can motivate the Indian base, what he has there. Guy runs international businesses. He's very tough on the campaign trail. He can win, but it's a Faustian bargain. Trump supporters like myself have to stick a clothespin up their nose to deal with the guy for a bigger picture. I don't know if I can do it. I don't know if I can do it. Ben, it's a big if. I don't know if I can do it. Maybe I can do it. He's my friend, but he drives me nuts. So I don't know. I doubt it. Ben Trippett, thanks for being with us. It's a dilemma for John Fredericks and the Trump supporters. You know, what do you do with David Ramadan? Because he just drives you.
You think because he's going to raise money, therefore he's going to win. These elections
he's
on the
just
ground.
A tough candidate, man. He's tough.
It depends.
And
it
he'll localize it too. He'll make it over the Greenway.
How much overlap was in his district and District 13? How much does Ron Meyer's district overlap to this and see who can get their voters out in the primary and see who's going to win? I think it's a toss-up.
30-year-old who's never had a legitimate job outside of political activism.
Voters don't care about that.
They do care about it. You just don't have experience to run a campaign of that size.
He's already run a campaign. He won a county board seat in Loudoun County, which is a large county.
I don't know.
I guarantee he's going to localize this issue. He's going to make about roads in Loudoun County, and schools in Loudoun County. And
he'll lose.
No, I don't think.
Very fine young man.
It's a toss up.
He's not a toss up. He'll lose. Ramadan's the guy, but I don't know if I can get there. Maybe I'll end up back in Meyer. I have absolutely no idea, Ben. I have no idea what I'm going to do, except on Sunday, I'm betting the Patriots. John Fredericks, Radio Network. I'm going to go against my father, who said never bet against the Chiefs at Arrowhead. Cindy, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it. She's a former federal prosecutor. She's the author of License to Lie. She's a senior fellow at the London Center for Policy Research. And License to Lie, one of the best books ever written on basically the Justice Department swamp. And you can buy it on her website, License to Lie. Cindy, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, John.
Let's get to the swamp. First of all, the New York Times article saying that the Justice Department, the FBI, thought that Trump was a foreign agent. What? Just comment on this for me.
I don't think I can use the one word on air. You know, it's a two-syllable word that's often used in Texas and generated in Texas. But obviously it's not true, because they knew all along that they had generated this entire baloney. And it's just the McCabe, Comey, Stroke faction of the liars and leakers trying to put their baloney out there for the consuming public in a fashion that might anybody might try to believe it.
Okay, Cindy, so it gets picked up by all the media. And so Donald J. Trump at the time, I mean, he owns a $10 billion business, or $8 billion, whatever number you want to say. It's a huge business. It's a real estate company. He's built hotels. He's built golf courses. He's built casinos. He built all this stuff. He's been all over the world. And, like, why on earth would he be a foreign agent for the Russian government? Like, it's so preposterous. It's even beyond the pale of us having a discussion about it, but it was actually out there and picked up by all of the media saying, oh, according to the New York Times, there's a possibility that our president is actually a foreign agent of the Russian government. And then they take it seriously, CNN, MSNBC, and all the other legacy fake newsers. Where are we going here?
Well, John, that's the ultimate lie they've been pushing since they began this whole thing. I mean, that's essentially what they were saying when they created the whole Steele dossier crap.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe Trump
there was really nothing new in that article. The only thing new there was that they formally opened the file.
Well, maybe Trump had a position on
the uranium. Creating from the beginning, the whole crap they've been creating from the beginning.
It is really unbelievable.
It's all completely manufactured.
All right. When is Mueller?
And they manufactured it, so they know it's not true.
Well, they made the whole thing up. They manufactured it, as you say. Now, my question is, where do we go from here? When is the Mueller investigation going to wrap up? I mean, when does this end? Does it just go on now in perpetuity? When do we get an ending to this and a report and findings? What happens?
Well, I would expect the ending to come fairly soon after Attorney General Barr is confirmed.
Right.
And so, that should be happening soon.
So why does Barr's confirmation have an influence on when the investigation by Mueller is wrapped up, Sidney Powell?
Well, I think he's going to go in there and say, Bob, give me your report. And supposedly Bob is working on the report now anyway.
Well, now let's get to another lie. I guess you'd call it a lie or misinformation coming out of the FBI. When it gets to the dossier and the FISA warrant, first they said that the judge was aware of it. Now they're saying they're not aware. The judge might not have been aware that it came from a opposition research dossier that was part of the FISA signing by the judge for the surveillance. Then they said the FBI said it was, well, it didn't happen until November. Now we're finding out that it was in August. Now we're finding out that this was pushed hard by the anti-Trump author of the dossier. I mean, at what point, Sidney Powell, do the people of this country ask for a clean and clear accounting of what the FBI's involvement in this was?
Well, I think the people of the country have been asking for a clean and clear accounting. We just haven't gotten one. And I don't know what it's going to take for us to get one.
So what's the end game here?
The end game is going to be up to Mr. Barr.
All right. And be a little more specific on that.
Well, I mean, right now he's the only hope we've got of getting the truth out.
And based on your experience, how would Barr do that?
Well, if I were he, I'd go in there with guns blazing and tell the inspector general to get on it. Of course, you know, Mueller's been holding up information from the inspector general, so Mueller needs to get finished, and then all the information needs to be shared and exposed.
All right.
This should be a big year for revelations.
Well, that would be nice to finally get this wrapped up. Thanks for being with us, Sidney Powell. You can read her book, License to Lie. License to Lie. Just go to License.
AM 600, 101.1 FM, WBOB.
With SRN News, I'm Gordon Griffin. The partial government shutdown has entered its second month with a proposal from President Donald Trump, unlikely to break the logjam. The president lashed out Sunday against House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats for dismissing his proposal to temporarily extend protections for young immigrants brought to the country illegally as children and those fleeing disaster zones. In exchange, the president still wants $5.7 billion for the border wall. A major winter storm brought some of the coldest temperatures of the season and blanketed a wide swath of the country in snow as it wreaked havoc on air travel and caused dangerously icy conditions throughout New England Sunday. It was a big comeback, a blown call, finally a booming kick that sent the L.A. Rams to the Super Bowl and a 26-23 victory. AFC Championship in progress, third quarter. New England leads Kansas City 14-7. This is SRN News.
Pat Boone here again, and I assure you, I have never before endorsed a pain relief product. Not until now. Not until Relief Factor came along as a 100% drug-free solution for people struggling with ordinary pain. Quite simply, Relief Factor was designed by doctors to help relieve those occasional aches and pains due to aging, exercise, and everyday living. Let me ask you, are aches and pains keeping you from sleeping through the night? Or keeping you from taking those nice long walks or playing golf or tennis? You can't really call it living if you can't get around comfortably. The 3-week quick start from Relief Factor may be all you need to lower or even eliminate these pains. A whole lot of people have already gone to ReliefFactor.com, and here's something you need to know. The majority of people who order the 3-week quick start, now only $19.95, go on to order more. Let's see if we can get you out of pain too. Go to relieffactor.com.
Hi, it's Mac with Baker Glass. If you're having trouble finding a clear option for that new shower enclosure or a replacement for that fog glass, then call the Baker Boys or find us at bakerglassinc.com. That's bakerglassinc.com. Baker Glass, no one treats you better. Hi, this is Mac with Baker Glass, where we use our more than 32 years of experience to provide a complete glass service to all of our customers and a clear choice for you. See for yourself at bakerglassinc.com. That's bakerglassinc.com. Baker Glass, no one treats you better.
Sean Robinson Realty has the ultimate real estate proposition for you. Own your own home. Sean Robinson Realty has likely sold or listed a property near you. If you close a home with Sean Robinson Realty, he'll give you a brand new big screen HD TV. Call 904-77-SEAN. That's 904-77-SHAWN. Sean Robinson Realty is your one stop for all of your real estate needs. Residential sales, commercial leases, or property management. Locally owned and operated by people who know your community. If you're looking to buy or sell a home or commercial property, don't waste your time. Call Sean Robinson Realty. Imagine getting a free big screen HD TV upon closing. Sean Robinson Realty will do it. Call 904-77-SEAN. That's 904-777-4296. 904-77-SEAN. Sean Robinson Realty.
WBOB is talk radio. There are a variety of ways to listen to WBOB. Streaming on the internet, on our mobile app, on 101.1 FM, and even on the AM dial. WBOB AM 600 is proud to broadcast all over the southeastern coast, from Georgia to Jacksonville to Orlando. No matter how or where you listen, WBOB is solid, reasoned talk radio.
Joining us now is Sean Kenny. Sean is the former executive director of the Republican Party of Virginia when it actually existed. Sean, great to have you with us.
I'm glad to have me on. Thank you.
All right, Sean, we got a lot to go over today, pipelines and stuff like that. That was kind of my opening, but we're going to agree to disagree probably. I don't get this ERA debate. I mean, why would you basically end the Republican Party as we know it in Virginia over a symbolic vote? Why would you do that?
Well, there's a certain interpretation of the ERA in states where it's been enacted where it enables equal access to things such as abortifacients. That's the concern. That's the reason why you're hearing the Family Foundation and other pro-life organizations oppose the ERA. Now, you know, you can say, well, it's like, well, don't we already have that? It's like, well, yes, we do. The problem is that it's not exactly enshrined as a constitutional right. You know, Roe v. Wade is pretty expansive. But, you know, the ERA sort of doubles down on that. So that's why you're hearing that complaint, that particular complaint from pro-lifers. You know, the flip side of that, of course, is that we've already kind of lost a lot of these battles, you know, writ large, and that the ERA vote is really symbolic in Virginia. It's not going to have the force or effect of law. So the timeline for the ERA, there's about 95% consensus that it's passed, right? You can't resurrect this. So this is more of a, you know, sort of, you know, I don't know if you want to use like moral preening or if you want to use, sort of like a victory lap that doesn't exist. But it's really, I mean, the opportunity to pass the ERA was in the late 70s, early 80s. That time has come and gone. You know, this is great fundraising for the Democrats, but it's not an open issue at this rate. I mean, I think most observers are looking at this, scratching their heads, saying, well, I guess. I mean, it's a bit of a, you know, a bit of a MacGuffin at this rate. It's like the Maltese Falcon. I mean, you get it, and then what happens? But again, at the end of the day, even if you have the symbolic vote, nothing really changes because you can't pass the ERA in Virginia anymore. So, you know, that's kind of it in a nutshell. There's not a whole lot of magic to it.
We're going to get to the pipeline here in a minute. Sean, how do the Republicans maintain control of the House of Delegates, right? They got a 51-49 majority. They only won that on basically a coin toss, or it would be split 50-50, right? They got all kinds of seats that they're going to get challenged on. They have a few they can pick up. It's going to be very, very close. But my contention is if the Democrats win this cycle, and I think they're going to win the state Senate, or certainly they're the favorite to do that because Dick Black's seat is a long shot for the Republicans to maintain. Having said that, their last firewall is Kirk Cox in the House. If you were running the Republican Party of Virginia right now, what's left of it, what would be your strategy to save the House for the Republicans and for Kirk Cox?
I mean, look, it's got to come down to bread and butter issues, right? I mean, it's the social issues that we continue to harp on. And believe me, I mean, you know me, John. I'm a pro-lifer. I'm a social conservative. I'm a practicing Catholic. You know, these things are very important to me, and I know that they're important to a lot of Republicans that are listening. But at the end of the day, we need to make sure that Virginia is a good place to start a business, is a good place to raise a family. It's a good place to work and raise kids and do all the things that are necessary to keep government out of our lives at the end of the day, to be self-sufficient. And at the end of the day, I don't think Republicans have really had a big idea to rally around since no car tax. You know, I mean, if you look at it, this is the 25th anniversary of George Allen's inauguration as governor, which is a long shot bid to begin with. It broke the back of the old Byrd machine. But even he was able, with a Democratic General Assembly, to pass several key things that mattered to the wallets and public safety of Virginians. He was even able to go ahead and pass parental notification in Virginia. So, you know, you get past the Allen administration into the Gilmore administration and no car tax. One really has to struggle to find the last time Republicans ran on something that galvanized the whole. I mean, certainly it wasn't going to be Corey Stewart waving little Confederate flags. You know, Bob's Jobs kind of started that. But you know, again, but there really wasn't a big idea behind the McDonald administration at the end of the day. It was just sort of, you know, a reaction against the Obama administration in 2008. You know, Cuccinelli certainly didn't provide that. You know, so you keep kind of pushing forward into these things. And what are we really doing that's addressing kitchen table issues? And, you know, opposing the ERA, okay, I mean, that's one thing, I guess. You know, you see the state Senate that's coming around with a $15 minimum wage. I mean, that's an easy one to get out and oppose. That's going to break the back of so many small businesses. But, you know, turning around, focusing on an education system that matters, getting ahead of the curve on automation, making sure that colleges and universities are affordable. I mean, Governor Allen and Governor Gilmore both have the courage to freeze tuition rates. That's something that's easy to get ahead of. You know, you've got the UVA slush fund. It's $2.3 billion that they malappropriated from Commonwealth taxpayers. And there's been absolutely no serious push about getting out there and getting it back getting it back to work for Virginia taxpayers other than keeping it ensconced in Charlottesville. I mean, think of what you could do with that for roads, for STEM academies, for making sure that tuition stayed down, for actually training people for the automation economy that's coming around the curve, you know, making sure that our energy prices are low, focusing on the Port of Virginia and making it an international port of call. There's all sorts of things we could be doing, John, but we're just not there because we're too afraid of protecting our flank. And as you know, if you're playing defense, you're not winning.
You just summed the whole thing up right there, Sean Kenny. You know, maybe if we get new leadership, you were to take over again as the executive director. I mean, you basically outlined it. I mean, they need a vision. And look, here's what Kirk Cox did, right? First day before it opened, is he outlines a major tax incentive package to align your Virginia state taxes with the Trump tax cut. So you have choice. You can go either state taxes. You can either go itemization or straight deduction. They want to increase the deduction. They want to make it easier for you. They want you to save money. And when I was at the General Assembly on Friday, all the Democrats were arguing against it. And do you know what their argument was? It's too complicated to figure out. That was their argument. like Virginians are really too stupid to figure out how to do their taxes and take advantage of it. That was their argument. Except for Marston, who, to his credit, said it was a great idea. So, I mean, other than that, you know, the others are surveilling them saying, oh, it's too complicated. I mean, that's their argument. When you say a big idea is that you can get behind, you know, Cox has nailed it. So, okay, let's go from there. I want to get to the pipeline. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline, Dominion Energy, Sean, the amount of money that is coming in opposing this now in the lawsuits. And we've got different companies being funded by this dark money that some people are tracing back to some pretty nefarious sources. I've got about 6 minutes. Can you outline where this money trail is for those that are opposing the pipeline? What is its genesis, Sean Kenny?
Well, the genesis, of course, is to keep energy prices higher, so as to keep those with an interest in that in Clover. I mean, so you go back and you look at the opposition to other pipeline projects, Keystone XL, for instance, in North Dakota. You'll find that the individuals that oppose this are pretty much of the environmentalist set. But again, there's connections towards you look at their activity online. They tend to mimic a lot of the Internet Research Agency tactics that you saw employed, not necessarily in favor of Trump one way or the other, but it was more against Clinton. But you'll see it, and also employed whenever there's an energy project in the United States that has the potential of lowering costs, because at the end of the day, the Russian government, along with the Venezuelans and others, rely on high energy prices, to help fund whether it's their military or their pensions and things of this nature. So you get back to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and the Mountain Valley Pipeline, and you'll see activity from the very same groups. If you look on Twitter, you'll find a lot of the very same accounts that were opposing Keystone XL or the same bots that ended up opposing the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and Mountain Valley Pipeline. When you look at the amount of money that's coming in, and you'll see these foundations that are funding these fake news agencies, like the Virginia Mercury, they're all funded from the same foundation, which have the same set of donors. These very same donors are the ones that are funding groups like Clean Virginia. Clean Virginia, of course, is making large donations to organizations like VPAP, who many people rely on for their morning news clips, which are heavily edited towards the left. all of this kind of comes around where if you start following the money trail, it starts leaning in one direction over another. And the pipeline, the trail for this isn't exactly a well-kept secret. House SST Committee has already published a report saying that the Russians tend to fund environmentalist groups because they know that if they do so, they can drive the cost of energy up, and any incremental increase ultimately helps the petrostate. And that's really where the end game lies. I mean, people need to be very skeptical about all this anti-Dominion or anti-pipeline talk, because at the end of the day, even though the supporters themselves may have genuine concerns, the people pulling the strings aren't necessarily being on the up and up as to why they're involved.
So let me get this straight. The objective of the dark money sources funding those that want to shut the Atlantic Coast Pipeline down, right? Their objective here is to keep energy prices high, because that's what this does. Tell me how that helps this group financially.
Well, of course, the thing is when you start tracing it back to their key funders, one of them being Michael Bills themselves, and he's the head of a $1.2 billion hedge fund. Who are those hedge fund managers? What's involved? We don't know. That's the real catch. Now, the flip side of this, of course, is when you start going back to House SST Committee and some of the reports they've cranked out, they will tell you point blank that there are investors here in the United States and abroad that have an eye towards making sure that energy prices stay north of $80 a barrel for gasoline. The reason why is because that's what makes these petrostates like Venezuela and the Russian Federation profitable at the end of the day. That's what helps them fund their pension systems and everything else. And so the real question now is that you have two ends of the string. On one hand, you have Russian money financing anti-energy campaigns, dabbling in American politics and whatnot. On the other hand, you have this activity from environmentalist groups who share the very same objectives but are getting their money from areas that we can't accurately trace because they're covered in layers of nonprofits and 501c3s and LLCs and things of this nature. And so you have to ask the question, who benefits at mm-hmm. the end of the day? Mm-hmm. And the more investigation we do, I mean, I think we'll be able to shed more light on it and get better answers.
Well, here's the bottom line. You know, the opposition to the pipeline is very fervent and very hysterical, and it really has nothing to do, in my judgment right now, Sean, Kenny, with any pipeline issue. It's got to do with those that just don't want any non-renewable sources of energy, period. They want sun and solar, and they'd rather go cold and hungry than ship gas through a pipeline. Because when you get to the natural gas issue, there's only three ways to get natural gas from its origin to people that need it, and that's a pipeline under the ground, a truck, or a train. That's it. Those are the only three ways to do it. Trucks overturn and have accidents. Trains go off the rails. There's never been a pipeline accident, to my knowledge, in the Commonwealth or anywhere in any of the surrounding states. Likely, you and I are standing on a pipeline. Sean, we got a 50-50 chance of standing over one right now. This state is riddled with pipelines all over the place that have never had an accident. So it just doesn't make any sense. So those that oppose this, they just don't want any sources of energy, or they don't want it going through their backyard, and they don't want to take the fair money that is provided for you when they buy it, the one-term buyout. So this is the real issue, but the hysteria on this pipeline is mind-boggling to me, because if you look at the facts, it brings jobs, it brings energy, it brings manufacturing, it brings more jobs, it brings economic growth to the areas it goes through. Everybody that's in the area that it doesn't go through their backyard wants it. It's going near my backyard. I want it. I just wish that I owned the land that it went on so I could get a check from them. I can just walk on it. The whole thing makes no sense. Sean, I want to thank you for being with us today. Sean Kenny, former executive director, Republican Party of Virginia. Sean, maybe you'll come back and be the RPVED again. What do you think?
We'll see about that.
Sean Kenny, for executive director of the Virginia Republican Party. Change, my friend, is in the air. Joining us now, Dave Bossi. Dave is the former deputy campaign manager of the Trump for President campaign. And he is now back with Citizens United, and he's also the author of two best-selling books, two of them. Number one, Trump Be Trump and Trump's Enemies, and he's also with Corey Lewandowski, and he's also, Dave Bossi, also is doing a new podcast called Deep in the Swamp. That's out every Wednesday. It'll be up today, and that is on their media company, which I'll give you a minute. Dave?
That's okay, John. How are you today?
Okay, fine. And
I learned you were buying a new radio station while I was on hold. So it is important, the conversation you're having about the State of the Union. Look, Nancy Pelosi is the Speaker of the American People's House. She's not Speaker of the Resistance. That's what we have to get to here. The American people have to understand that when you're in those jobs, you have to put aside your feelings. Look, I say this routinely. Nancy Pelosi and her caucus hate this president more than they love the country. Mm-hmm. Actions like this prove me correct over and over and over again. Look, if I was in the White House today, I would be on the phone with Mitch McConnell and say, Majority Leader, would you have the president do the State of the Union in front of the United States Senate, just on the other side of the Capitol, and just call Nancy Pelosi's bluff?
Because as soon as Mitch McConnell announces that the president's going to give the State of the Union from the other chamber, which is perfectly fine, it's just a tradition to do it from the House. And by the way, it's a fairly recent tradition, too, I might add. George Washington came in person, I think, twice and then mailed it in because he was so frustrated with Congress. So this is not anything that is that big a deal from where it's done. But I would just call Mitch McConnell and say, Senator, let's have it over in the Senate. And then it puts Nancy Pelosi in a big box, and you show the American people for exactly who you're dealing with.
That's brilliant.
So have you talked to the president or anybody in his team, Dave Bossy? That is an idea that at a scale of 1 to 10 is a 10.9. That would be brilliant. Do you think he would be open to that?
Well, you know what? The president's interested in solutions. Okay, that's the one thing that people, you know, whether you agree with him or disagree with him on any particular issue, the president is trying to get things done. He's trying to get things done for every American, whether it's for the economy or on our national security and trying to bring troops home and ending these never-ending wars. He doesn't ask people party registration when he's trying to get them a job. He's just trying to help and raise up every American. That's the job of the president, just as it's the job of the Speaker of the House to try to help all Americans, regardless of party. These people have lost their minds, and they've lost their way. And it's unfortunate that we're in for 2 years of this, and to be quite candid, I think it's just the beginning, because you're going to see with the investigations, because they're not doing that now because they want to stay focused on this, but the Democrats, the left in the House, they're going to just, as soon as the government reopens, they're going to be hammering this White House with ridiculous subpoenas and depositions to, you know, their famous subpoena cannon that they're going to have. So it's going to continuously be a problem for this White House dealing with this House. So I think it's just going to be pretty amazing.
All right, Dave Bossy, so I love the idea. The president should just go to Mitch McConnell and say, look, I'll do it in the Senate. I think that's a great idea, because not only has she rescinded the offer, but she blamed security, which immediately Chris Nielsen, who's in charge of it, came out and disputed it, which I thought really made her look ridiculous. But now the Democrats are saying they're not even going to show up, that half the chamber would be empty. Where are they, Dave, where are they going with this?
You know, I think that the president's going to give his State of the Union, and I think, you know, we need to, as a White House and as the party, whether it's Kevin McCarthy and Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan in the House, Mitch McConnell and his ally and the president's allies in the Senate, it is our job to try and help this president work through this problem. This is not any one person's problem or one person's solution. But good people have to come up with great ideas. And I think, you know, this one of going to the Senate is probably, I hope, is already being discussed, you know, because it's a solid effort, in my opinion, to show Nancy Pelosi that she is just not, you know, Speaker of the world, and that, you know, really to put her in her place. I think that needs to happen, and I think it needs to happen very quickly.
All right. Well, certainly I'll be seeing the president today. He's got a meeting with his top TV media and radio surrogates. I'm invited to that. If I can squeeze that in, I'm going to definitely mention it, because I think that is a great idea. Just go right to the Senate. Dave Bossy with us. Dave Bossy.
What time is that? Because I wasn't invited to that, so maybe
3:30, I think. 2:30 or 3:30. I got to look at my email. But the top, I guess, surrogates in media, I think 2:30 or 3:30 today. I'm not exactly sure. That's why I got to get out of town and head up there. Dave Bossy with us. He's the author of 2 New York Times bestselling books with Corey Lewandowski. He's a former deputy campaign manager of the Trump campaign. Let Trump Be Trump is number 1. Trump's Enemies, number 2. You can buy them. It's the easiest thing to do. Just go to my website, johnfredericksradio.com. There's an ad for them there. Click on it. Takes you straight there. You can buy it. Also, he's the author with Corey of a new podcast, Deep in the Swamp. You can find that on roughrider.media. That's roughrider.media. And I'm going to be sending this week's out today in my newsletter also. Dave, I want to get, if I may, to very quickly, I want to get to the Mueller investigation. Now we find out more evidence through one of the FBI directors involved in this, or that the first FISA request was rejected. The second FISA request application that they got signed for the surveillance was all about the dossier. They never put on the application that it was paid for by the Democrats. First, the FBI said it was done in November. Now we're finding out it was done in August. Their stories, Dave, are not matching here. When is there going to be some scrutiny on this entire Mueller process, Dave?
Well, first of all, John, you mentioned our podcast. Corey and I talk at length and really in depth about this very issue in this week's podcast that we did late last night. So I urge folks to go find our podcast, and you can find it anywhere you download podcasts. Search for our name, search for Deep in the Swamp, and you can find it, on Apple or the other platform. So we're excited about this, and that's the reason that we wrote the book Trump's Enemies, to really dig down and articulate exactly what James Comey and Andy McCabe and Strzok and Page and all of these others, including James Baker, the then general counsel of the FBI, somebody who is paid to be an arbiter, somebody who is at the top echelon, the number one lawyer at the FBI, who is supposed to protect Americans from all of the bad actors that could possibly be around, to make sure that everybody's on the straight and narrow, that he himself was leaking information to the media to harm President Trump and to harm then-candidate Trump. This is outrageous that we wrote about this in Trump's Enemies. But it is outrageous that the American people are just now finding this out, and it is really something that is going to have to be delved into much deeper. And so when the House is doing the facade of these investigations, this is actually something that the House should be investigating. It should be investigating James Baker and Comey and McCabe's lying and perjury before the House. And even in behind closed doors in their depositions they sat for. So this is a very important issue, and the American people and your listeners need to understand the depths of what the enemies of the president were trying to do, and the depths and lengths that they went to try to stop him from being president.
Unbelievable, Dave Bossie, what is going on. And the subpoenas are going to start. Let me just ask you, I've only got another minute, but does the president have an internal staff prepared to handle the number of allegations that are going to be coming his way, like Clinton did in 98 when you guys were starting the impeachment hearings?
Yeah, I was the chief investigator for the House during the Clinton investigation. So I know from the other side exactly what they're going to do. And the House rules and opportunities and the defenses that need to be used, the House rules that you need to use.